Welcome to Bobby Osinski's Inner Circle. I'm Bobby Osinski, and this is a show all about music, music production, and the music business. My guest today is the great mastering engineer, Vlado Meller. But first of all, Nielsen Music did a little analysis on all of the downloads and all of the streams that we listened to in 2015. And what they discovered was that our listening habits are way different than what the radio might tell you. For instance, the most listened to genre of music was actually rock at 29%. Next was R&B and hip hop at 17.2%. And following that was pop music at 14.9%. Country came in after that at 11.2%. Dance EDM at 3.4%. Christian and gospel at 3.1%. Holiday and seasonal, 2.6%. Latin, 2.6%. Jazz at 1.4%, classical 1.4%, and children's music at 1%. So the interesting thing here is if you listen to the radio, mostly what you're hearing these days are pop music and country music. But the fact of the matter is our tastes are much broader than that. And what we're listening to is more rock music and more R&B and hip hop, even though the popular music stations on the radio don't really exhibit that at all. If you listen to any of the top radio stations just about anywhere in the country, what you're going to find is it's mostly pop and country. And you're going to have very, very little rock. And you will have some hip-hop, but not hardcore hip-hop like we're used to listening to, those of us who like that genre. So it's really interesting because our tastes are much different than what radio is giving to us. This makes you wonder just how in touch radio actually is with people that are actually listening to it. Another thing that you find is if you listen to AM radio at all, and I listen a lot to AM radio, I listen to talk radio, and I also listen to sports a lot. And what you find is there are fewer and fewer really solid advertisers on AM radio, which used to be the bastion of music. And there's a lot more public service announcements, which makes you think that AM radio is really on its last legs. And FM isn't all that far behind, considering that it doesn't really represent our tastes. So keep a lookout on what's going to happen with radio in the next 3 or 4 years, because we're pretty much changing to streaming, and what we're listening to on streaming is not what we're hearing on the radio. If you have any questions or comments, send them to questions@bobbyownercircle.com. I just launched a new mini coaching program, and it's called Lead and Background Vocal Mixing Tricks, as well as a live mixing workshop where I'll personally help you with your mixes. Go to bobbyosinskicourses.com to learn more. Another news item this week is the fact that Avid, oh, the company we love to hate, Avid is restructuring yet again. It's trying to save a bunch of money, and it thinks it can save $68 million this year by downsizing. So what's going to happen is a lot of Avid offices are going to close, and a lot of Avid is actually going to be moved offshore. Rumor has it that all their technical support is going to be moved from Massachusetts over to the Philippines. And right now, what they're doing is some massive hiring over there, which kind of backs that up. Avid also just opened up offices in Poland and Taiwan. So what does that tell you? Well, it's cheap labor, and it's cheap technical labor. So what we're finding here is Avid, once again, is doing just the thing that we knew they'd always do and they've been doing since Avid bought Pro Tools. Essentially what that is they care more about their investors than they do about their customers, because this is definitely a play for investors. They want their stock to go up. They don't much care about their end users, because if that was their main concern, we'd have a lot more things that would be going on that would be more attractive to end users. There'd be more frequent updates, for instance. There'd be more new features than what we're getting. And of course, the technical support would be growing in the US rather than moving offshore. So that's not a good sign. The only good sign in all of this is the fact that Avid just got a new $105 million line of credit, which means at least that if you're a subscriber to Pro Tools 12, that you can rest assured that we're going to see a couple years of safety in that subscription. But other than that, don't know what to say. I subscribe myself. I'm on Pro Tools 12, and that's what we're recording on right now. I reluctantly went that way, kicking and screaming, but the fact of the matter is, I, just like a whole lot of other people, are looking around to see what might be the next digital audio workstation in line. My guest today is the great mastering engineer Vlado Meller, whose credits read like a who's who of the music business. Vlado's done projects for everyone from the Beastie Boys to Pink Floyd to Kanye West to Barbra Streisand and many, many more over his 43-year career. One of the best stories is about how he fled from his native Czechoslovakia during the Russian invasion that ended up in his working at CBS Studios in New York City. I spoke to Vlado from his studio in Charleston, South Carolina. Your background is pretty amazing. I'd love to hear more about it.
Well, I'm sure you read something already about it. And, I can give you a short description of how I started and, you know, how far I got with my business.
Let's start right from the beginning, because one of the most interesting aspects of your life is growing up in Czechoslovakia and then leaving. Can you tell me about that?
Yes, I grew up in Czechoslovakia. And I decided to go to school in Prague to study electrical engineering, which my parents were okay with. They sent me to Prague. And as you well know, in 1968, in August of 1968, Russia invaded Czechoslovakia. Well, as a rebel young student in Prague, even though I enjoyed Prague and, you know, university very much, I saw what was happening around me and all the young people were running. And they were running out of the country. And the only way you could run is Austria has a border with Slovakia. And from capital of Slovakia to capital of Vienna, it's only like 35 kilometers, you know, but there's a Danube River separating the two towns. And that's the only western border which was completely open. Even the Russians were busy taking every government building, every army barrack, and in every city in the country. So somebody told me, and I asked people, you know, how do they run? Where do they go? I said, well, you know, you go back to Slovakia and you can cross from Bratislava, which is capital of Slovakia, to Vienna with very, very little ease. You know, there's no border guards, nobody stopping anything. So I took a train home. It's an overnight train home to my hometown of, it's called Košice, which is like one of the most eastern towns in Slovakia. It's almost at the Russian border. And I announced to my parents that I'm leaving. Well, they were like, what's wrong with you? Where are you going? You know, I said, I'm leaving. I mean, all my friends at the university are gone. You know, I was in my dorm starting a third year at the university. There was nobody there. So they said, well, how will you go? I mean, what are you, sick? What are you, crazy? I mean, they just couldn't understand what I'm doing. I decided to leave because I know if I don't do it now, I'll never do it again. Because after university, I would have to join the army. It's a mandatory service, minimum 3 years. And I would have to probably join the Communist Party because obviously I would be engineer educated. There's no way you could not join. And I said to my parents, I'll take a chance. If it doesn't work out, I'll return back. Well, I was very naive. You can't return back. Obviously, I'll be in prison if I would return back.
Yeah.
So I did it. I took a train to Bratislava, hopped on a train to Austria. There were probably 300 or 400 other people like me, mostly young people. And the train stopped at the border. The border guards, Slovak border guards came on and they asked for passports. Well, very few people had passports or papers because obviously you can't get a passport to go out to Western country in Czechoslovakia in 1968. So most of the people just wait. They don't have it. I don't have it. I have my school papers. I have my music school papers. Whatever I needed, I had with me, but I don't have a passport. So they just waited us. They said, okay. And pretty much, I would say 85% of the people on the train had no passports.
Wow.
So we got to the other side, and Slovak guards wouldn't do anything. They wouldn't take us off the train, and I tell you why. At that time, I didn't know. But now I think I can understand. They were afraid that if they would, let's say, shoot us or they would take us off, they would be the next casualty if something goes wrong and the Russia returns back to Russia, at least Czechoslovakia alone. And it's pretty much like East Germany shooting their own people, you know. These people paid a heavy price.
Yeah.
So four of our guards just let us go after 5 or maybe 10 minutes. When the train crossed the Danube River, the Austrian guards came on. And same questions, passports. Well, first of all, very few people had passports. Few of them who had, they showed the passports. But they knew that they were all refugees. They were all running. They were young people, pretty much no suitcase, no nothing. You're pretty much running with a little bag, you know, one spare pair of pants and shirt and your school papers. That's about it. So they put us on the bus. They took us off the train, put us on the bus, and took us to Vienna. And that's where my journey started, in Vienna. It was in October of 1968.
Wow.
So here I am, young guy. I was 20, just about 20 years old, I think, going on 21. In Vienna, can't speak German, can't speak English. Only language I spoke was Russian. And Slovak, and maybe a little bit of Hungarian. And I was told in school for 20 years that the Russian is a worldwide language. I was very proud of it.
Yeah.
It just shows you how brainwashed we were, you know. So first thing, when I went on interview in Austria, I started to speak Russian to them. And people who interviewed me, they asked me, like, can't you speak any other language? I mean, you can't understand a word they're saying. And I had a Slovak interpreter. Interpreter over there, and they told me that you better stop speaking Russian, either speak German, French, or English. And me, stupid, naive old kid, I keep telling them I speak Russian. What's wrong with that? Well, obviously, I realized very quickly this was all BS, you know, brainwashing for 20 years, and I believe that stuff. So, next thing you know, they gave us people who could speak our language so they could communicate with us and get more information from me, because obviously you're pretty much stateless. They don't know where you're coming from, who you are. They have to pretty much verify everything. So I was invited to American Embassy and went to the whole interview. It was in Slovak, which I can understand very well. And they asked me 10,001 questions, why I'm running, where I want to go. And I expressed a desire to go to the United States. And they told me it wouldn't be so easy because all these things will have to be checked. My background, my family, my school, my education, where I'm coming from, who am I. And it took almost altogether. I was in Austria in October. I was let. I was transferred to Italy 2 months later, to Rome, and my interviews continued in Rome at the American Embassy, and finally, around March of 1969, I was allowed to come to the United States as a refugee. And the U.S. was very sympathetic at that time to refugees from Czechoslovakia, because what was going on, U.S. was busy protesting at the U.N. and publicly that, you know, Russia should stop this invasion. It's an insanity. They're trying to start a World War III and this and that. So U.S. was very open to refugees, you know, and there were refugees from Czechoslovakia, from Hungary, from Poland, whoever could run, they run. Because nobody knew what will happen. I mean, some people thought it would be a start of World War III.
Yeah.
But as you know very well, nothing happened. I mean, the West just accepted the invasion, and it was just a continuation of Cold War, Iron Curtain and everything else.
In Prague, were you there when the tanks rolled in, or did you get out before?
I got right after that. The tanks rolled in end of August, and I started my school like September 7th or September 8th. So I came there, but I saw what was going on. You could see the bullet holes in the buildings on Venceslav Square. And I immediately talked to people who were still there. You know, there were Czech students who came back to school, and some of the Slovaks in this case that were there, and they were telling me it was horrible. You know, one guy set himself on fire, and you could see what was going on. I mean, young generation was scared to death because we didn't know what would happen. You know, I mean, I was just a young, naive kid, you know, who grew up over there, was educated over there, and next thing you know, your own brothers are invading you. This was very hard to explain to me.
Because
we were taught the Russians were our brothers, were peacekeepers, were our saviors. Americans were ones who were capitalists, aggressive. They were ready to kill us. They were ever, I remember in, what was it, in 56, 57, when the Hungarian Revolution, I was still young, very young kid. But my parents started telling me, you know, there was a revolution in Hungary because people wanted to go independent. Then Cuban crisis, I remember it very well, you know, because we were taught in school how to hide in basements and under the tables in case there's a nuclear war. Well, you imagine that one, you know, survive nuclear war.
No, I remember that too. I remember that too, yeah.
Yeah, and the first thing was every time they would say something, they would attack the United States. I mean, U.S. was the willing, just the worst description you can imagine, you know, aggressor. They started all the wars. They're ready to kill the world. And I mean, I don't know. I'm just a young kid. You know, what do I know? You know, and I knew about Second World War because I'm Jewish and my parents were, my father was in a concentration camp and my mother was hiding during the war. So I knew what was going on. But, you know, we always thought that Russia liberated the whole Czechoslovakia, pretty much liberated the whole Europe. That's what we were taught.
Yeah.
And since I could never travel to West, I could never see a Western newspaper or Western magazine, I believed all that stuff, you know. That's what they tell you. That's what you learn, you know, they teach you. So I, later on, when I was in college, because of the foreign students, we had foreign students from Sweden, from Germany, from, you know, from different countries. And they could travel to West Germany on the weekend because Prague is not far from West Germany. They could take a train and they could travel. I could not travel. And suddenly I realized that there must be something wrong, you know. I mean, here is my buddy who I hang out in a class. He can go to Berlin, to West Berlin on the weekend and come back with the Life magazine and Time magazine and chocolates and 45s, singles, maybe even LPs from Western music. And here I cannot do it. I can only go to Hungary, Russia, or Poland. So I realized something is wrong. This is, they just denying that there is a world behind a curtain, behind a west, behind the borders, you know. So well, I started to be a little bit more open to this Western culture and music and everything else when I was in college. That's when I picked it up that it's not really only the communist world under Russia. There is a whole another world on the other side of the fence. And when the opportunity came, that's what I took.
Well, let's talk about when you got to the United States then. How did you become a mastering engineer? Because it's one of those things, especially when you started, there weren't a lot of mastering engineers. No one really knew what that was. So how did that happen to you?
Well, I tell you what. In Czechoslovakia, my parents signed me for the music lessons when I was very young. And I started to play violin when I was like probably 6 or 7 years old. And I had to go to these music lessons up to the start of my college, and they really forced me into it. I never enjoyed very much violin, but they insisted that I should play either classical, you know, classical music, either piano or violin. And the reason was, really, I can realize it now why, because when you became a classical musician, the only chance to travel to the West was with the orchestra.
Oh, yeah.
Because Czechoslovakian orchestra had a chance to go to Berlin, they had a chance to go to Paris. So they always figure out that if I'll be good at it and I'll become a violinist, maybe one day I'll get out, you know, openly without, you know, me escaping. At that time, they didn't think about that I would escape. So I studied music, and but I wanted to be an electrical engineer.
Mm-hmm.
So I had a knowledge of music very well, classical music, because that's the only music you can listen over there. And once in a while, I would listen to some pop music secretly on my shortwave radio at home. Radio Luxembourg used to have a hit parade every weekend. And I would try to tune into it and listen to it, because I heard in Prague, you know, there's such a good music coming out from the West. And I'd like to hear it on my own. So we had a shortwave radio. And sure enough, around, you know, in the afternoon, around 2-3 o'clock in the afternoon, here comes Radio Luxembourg, the hit parade.
Yeah.
It was all in English. I couldn't understand, but music is music. So I listened to music. And, you know, I remember all the early rock and, you know, Dave Clark 5, Chuck Twist. What was it? Twist Again.
Oh, right.
Monkeys, you know, all these in late 60s, all these British bands, you know, started to come up on these waves, you know, and I just loved the music. And So when I was in school at the university with foreign students, I would ask him to bring his singles for me, like 45s.
Yeah.
And, you know, they could buy it openly, with no problem. I mean, they paid whatever they paid, few cents, few dollars in West Berlin, and they would bring me a 45. Next thing you know, I have a Chubby Checker, Twist Again.
Yeah.
And suddenly, you know, Beatles was huge. I mean, I was totally obsessed with Beatles, you know. I started to collect the pictures, and I had a little dark room. I would multiply the pictures, create new black and white pictures, gave it to my friends and everything. I was totally obsessed with music. You know? I mean, I could not believe what kind of music is being played on the other side of the fence.
Yeah, yeah.
So when I came to New York, I was looking for a job, and it never crossed my mind that I would ever find a job in the recording. I just didn't think that it was possible. So I was looking for a job in engineering, you know, like maybe go back to school, graduate, finish my electrical engineering, and have a job and live happily after. Well, guess what? You know, I meet a guy in New York who was with me in Rome. He was a refugee from Poland. And one day I met him on the street in New York City, and I asked him, where do you work? Because I had some jobs, like totally BS jobs, you know, paying minimum wage under the table. He was in a technical electrical department, you know, like electrical engineering departments, but it wasn't paying good, you know, and I didn't think that this was a really future for me. At one point, I was almost thinking, you know what, if it doesn't go better for me, maybe I'll return. I'll face the courts and whatever happens. So he tells me that he works at CBS Records. And I'm like asking him, what's CBS Records? To me, it's three letters in the alphabet. I have no idea what it is. So he's telling me, yeah, it's a studio. They have a studio on 52nd Street in Manhattan. You should come over. You should see it. There's a recording studio. There's a Arthur Godfrey had a studio, a radio studio over there. He was doing the live shows from there. And they have mastering. I was like, what's mastering? I mean, okay, a recording studio I knew. I mean, I've seen studios in Czechoslovakia, a recording studio. But mastering, what's mastering? So he told me he's there already a few months, and it's a beautiful job. You know, he loves it, and it's like, I should come over and check it out. So, okay, I couldn't wait to get in. I told him, tell me when. I'll be there tomorrow if you want me. So I said, you know what? You cannot come just like, I have to ask my boss and see if he'll accept you, you know, to come over to see the place. So his boss said, yeah, if the guy is as good as you and he's reliable and he will know what we are asking to do over here, bring him over. Maybe we'll hire him too, because the Polish guy was a really good maintenance guy. It's a technical guy. He was maintaining equipment in a studio.
Yeah.
And the reason he got into the studio, because his uncle worked at CBS Record, CBS TV. So you had to have some kind of connection to get the CBS Records.
Yeah.
And his connection was his uncle, who was living here in the United States. And he got him a job at CBS Records. But the kid was technically very good. He was very similar background. Went to college, and he escaped from Poland pretty much the same way I, in the middle of his studies, you know. But he was a technically very good guy, you know. He could fix anything you threw at him, you know. Amplifier, broken headphone, you know. He was just good. So the boss told him, bring your Czechoslovakian friend over here, and if he can do the same thing what you're doing over here, maybe we'll hire him, because at that time CBS Records was expanding exponentially.
Yeah, yeah.
They were building studios in San Francisco. They were building studios in California. They were building studios in Mexico City. I mean, this was a major expansion of CBS Records. I mean, I was there. Like, you know, they say in this country, you have to be in the right place at the right time with the right people. Well, guess what? I hit it right on the head.
What year was this? Was this like 1971, 72, somewhere in there?
No, 1969. December 1969.
Oh, God.
I came here in March of 1969 in December. I mean, actually, it was November, because I was hired. December 1st, I was working already. I was on the payroll.
Yeah. Okay.
So I came in, and his boss, he was a technical genius for CBS Records. I can say his name. He passed away, I don't know, maybe 10 years after I came to the studio there. His name was Eric Porterfield. And he was the chief engineer designer for CBS Record Studios around the world. It's his homemade console, because CBS used to manufacture their own consoles for recording, for mastering. They were in London, they were in LA, they were in San Francisco, they were in New York studio at 52nd Street, Nashville, Mexico City, you name it. When CBS built a studio, he was the chief designer, and they had a huge technical department. They used to call it maintenance. Now they would call it a technical services.
Yeah.
And we were actually building everything from the scratch. CBS would buy the components and build a console right on 49 East 52nd Street on the 8th floor of the studio. They would order the machine parts, you know, the metal parts from some other vendor in New York City. They would be delivered over there, and we would be wiring and wiring and wiring and installing the components which they bought, but actually framed the console as made right there at 49 East.
Is that what you were doing? You were building the consoles?
Yeah. Yeah, I was hired in the technical services to do wiring, jack rows. You know, it was all WEs, you know, the big jack rows for the studios.
Yeah.
The consoles. The mastering console was still very, very little known. You know, there wasn't much. At mastering at that time used to be a tape machine and a cutter, and that's about it, you know, and whatever equipment you had, like cutting amplifiers and everything. There was no EQs in between or anything. You would go straight from the tape into the vinyl.
Yeah.
So, but later on, 3 years into it, they started to build mastering console, but I was already mastering engineer at that time. So I worked in that tech department for a year, maybe not even a full year, till 1970. By middle of 1970, the boss, the person who hired me, was very nice. I mean, he was very sympathetic to me and very sympathetic to Polish guy, because, you know, we were very good workers, we were very conscientious, and we did good work, you know. I mean, he was always amazed how clean the soldering jobs were, how perfect the wiring was. You know, there was no mistakes. You know, they could just go and buzz the console, you know, with our wiring, and hardly ever there was any problem. And we were just so conscientious, so happy to have a job. Normally, you know, you would put 100% to your work. We put 150%, because I realized this is the job. This is a dream job. You know, if I screw it up, I'll be out on the street in no time.
Yeah.
So we were really, instead of 8 hours, we would be sitting there 10 hours. Instead of 7 o'clock in the morning starting time, I would be there 6 o'clock. People would leave at 4:30, 5 o'clock. I would leave 6:30.
Yeah.
So they really loved it. I mean, the boss was like really impressed. I think they were the only two guys over there who really cared. Most of the people over there just worked 9 to 5, took their salaries, and went home.
Was it union?
It was a union job.
Yeah, yeah, okay.
Yeah? Yeah. So in the middle of the year of 70, Eric comes to me and asks me, like, what, are you happy over here? I mean, you know, I can't tell, you know. I mean, you have a good job, you have a good salary and everything. Are you happy? And I said, I'm very happy, but I just can't see myself to do this kind of wiring and preparation for studio sessions. I would go in the morning down before the session starts and make sure that all the patches are clean, make sure all the tape machines are aligned. It was very routine, same job day after day after day after day. It was really boring. I wasn't there when the artists came in and they started to record. Only time I would go down there, if they had a problem, they would call me. I had to go immediately down and try to fix the problem. So it would be either me or a few other guys who specialize in the console, guy who specialize in the tape machine, and we would try to correct the problem immediately, because time is valuable. They can't wait over the 4 hours while the session is going on. So we would see the artists, we would see the mixers, producers, and I was fascinated. I always said, you know, this is the job I would love. I would love to be in a studio. I mean, mixing job, this would be unbelievable. I would be so happy. So I told him exactly that. I said, Eric, I really appreciate you giving me a job, but maybe I would love to go to the studio, like work as a master, no, not master, as a mixing engineer. And he looked at me and said, Lotto, you're really naive. I mean, this is a union place. The last hired is the first fired.
Mm.
Yeah. There are already people in the mixing positions, because they had in-house mixers at that time.
Yeah.
And they said, these people I work for, some of them are 5 years, some are 10 years, 15 years. You have a long way to go. Somebody would have to die or leave for you to get the job. There's no other way. And I said to him, well, what else? Like, what other jobs would you recommend to me? And he says, how about mastering? What we'll do, we'll create a custom mastering room for you. And I was like, what's custom mastering? At that time, all the mastering rooms were, like I told you, tape machine, cutting amplifier, and a Scully or a Neumann lathe. There's nothing in between. You couldn't just go and equalize the program for the client over there and change the sound on them. It was pretty much straight transfer from a tape to the client.
Right.
He said, we'll build you a nice little room. We'll give you a little console. We'll give you some EQ piece, some pull-tech equalizers, some limiters, some high-frequency limiters. So you could work with the clients, because suddenly, you know, all the A&R people at Columbia and Epic were young people. I mean, they were young in their 20s and 30s. And the average age for the engineer at CBS Records was more like 50, 55, 57.
Yeah.
So he says, you'd be a perfect guy to start this trend in mastering. We'll build you a console, we'll build you a room. And they had tons of rooms over there. They had like 6 or 7 mastering rooms, but like I told you, very simple rooms.
Yeah.
They'll build you a nice room. They'll call it a custom mastering, and you can work with clients. You can work with a young A&R and do your work. Would you take that? And I said to him, like, mastering didn't look very exciting to me, especially when, you know, I saw the tape going into, you know, the vinyl immediately. And it was exciting to see, you know, how the record is cut, but it wasn't as exciting as mixing.
Yeah.
And he says, you have to give it a try. But again, we have to wait for somebody to retire or somebody leave or something, and I'll let you know as soon as there's opening, you'll get it. Well, guess what? Within like a month and a half, 2 months, this was like mid-70s, late-70s, I get a call from Eric. He says to me, come up to my office. So I come up to his office. Guess what? I think the gentleman either, I forgot if he retired or passed away, I don't know. He says, there's a room, and you can take it tomorrow. You can go there, and they'll train you, they'll teach you, they'll do everything for you. You'll become a mastering guy. I said, all right, I'm for it. Sure enough, the next thing I know, they build a console. It didn't take long, because obviously they could build a recording console in less than a month, so a mastering console was nothing.
Yeah.
They gave me EQs, they gave me limiters, LA3As, they gave me filters. It was a nice little setup. It was a crude-looking console. Again, CBS, they were building their own. It didn't look any professional way like Neumann console would look, but it had a good gear in it. And it was wired by me and my friends, you know, so I knew that everything is perfect. You know? And I had a double lathe, believe it or not. I had 2 Scullies in tandem, so I could cut 2 masters at once.
Wow.
And I had people who were there, older gentlemen. They were all in their late 50s, maybe early 60s. They were the original cutters at CBS Records. And they gave me a good training. Every single day, I would either go to their room or they would come to my room. And they would show me from A to Z how to cut the lacquer.
Wow.
And by 1972, I was cutting on my own, with people, with clients from Epic Records, from Columbia, from Associated Labels. And other than that, the word spread. There's this young kid, you know, he's from Yugoslavia. They didn't know where I'm from. And he's good. He cuts these masters, you know, and you should try. Next thing I know, I get a call from RCA. I get a call from Warner Brothers. I used to get calls from different labels to cut the lacquers.
Wow.
For them. And CBS would tell me at that time, you can't do that. You know, cannot do that. You know, we only care about our own artists. We don't care about Warner Brothers. We don't care about RCA. We don't care about anybody. Just shows you how the business was run. And I said to them, well, why? I mean, these people would pay. They would come over here and pay you, and I was on salary. It's not like I'm gaining anything. The only thing I would gain is maybe overtime, because that was my bonus overtime, you know, union scale.
Yeah.
So first they refused. And then next thing I know, I was doing a job for Grover Washington. You remember the Wine Light?
Sure.
The song?
Yeah.
Ralph McDonald, who was a producer, and he contacted me and said, "Father, would you cut the record single for us?" And I said, "You know what? I don't know if they're going to allow it, but I'll try. I'll talk to somebody over here, and I'll try to cut it." Well, guess what? They wouldn't allow me. So as a rebel, again, I took the job outside. I went to Frankfurt Wayne, which was another mastering studio privately owned.
I remember it.
On Broadway. Yeah, that's where Ed Sullivan Theater is now.
Yeah.
And I talked to the owner, and I said to him, "You know, you'll laugh at me, because I knew where I'm coming from, CBS Records. Meanwhile, we have 7 mastering rooms over there, and I'm asking him if I could cut the single over there." And he says to me, "Yeah, well, if you want, you know, we'll give you some money, but, you know, you have to give us whatever percentage and, you know, do whatever you want to do." So I cut the record. The record exploded. It's exploded. That became a number one single. It immediately went gold. Next thing I know, I'm doing an album. So Ralph McDonald came to me. "You want to cut it here? You want to cut it there? I mean, you know, let me ask Sony. I mean, CBS. I mean, this is crazy. I don't want to jeopardize my job at this. I mean, they don't like if I go outside. You know, I'll try to do it in-house." Well, suddenly they realize it's not such a bad deal to do outside clients at CBS Records, because they pay. It's all about payment, you know, and they would pay. I cut the record. The record went platinum. Next thing I know, next big album comes, Pink Floyd Animals.
Huh.
It was recorded on 43rd Street at a record plant at that time.
Yeah.
Downstairs of a huge studio, and there was a call to CBS Records to the booking department, which was on the 7th floor, 6th floor of the building. And they were looking for this little guy, you know, his name is Waldemir. We would like him to cut the ref for a new Pink Floyd album. And the lady from the department comes down and says, "You know, there was a call over here for you, and they don't even know your name, but they would love you to go over to 43rd Street, pick up the master, cut the record for them, and take it back." So I go there. I knew about Record Plant. I knew it was a major studio, because obviously all the superstars are recording over there. Not at CBS Records, they're recording at the Record Plant. So I go there, and sure enough, the producer, the engineer, they were very unhappy with the cut they had from their own studio. They had a cutting room on the top floor of the building, too, where they cut the records.
Yeah.
I don't know if it belonged to Record Plant, but it was a cutting room over there. So they gave me a 2-track master of Pink Floyd, put it in an envelope, and they told me, "Take it with you. Don't let it slip out of your hands, because we need this master back." Imagine, I walked with a master of Pink Floyd.
Yeah,
I even
didn't
realize how big that thing was, you know.
Yeah.
"You cut the record, cut the ref for us, you bring it back, and we'll compare it. And if it's good, then you're the guy." All right. Took it back, took it to my cutting room, put it on. And then I realized, oh my God, this is unbelievable. This is fucking unbelievable. You know, I'm doing a Pink Floyd Animals album. This is crazy.
Yeah.
And especially if they told me they didn't like the other guy. So I made sure that it will be so good and truthful to the tape. I don't know if you know about cutting, but to cut the 31 minutes of program like Pink Floyd and then make sure everything sounds great, it's almost impossible.
Yeah, right.
Because, you know, longer the record, more problems you have on the vinyl, you know, especially with the high end when you go in and everything. So I cut the ref. I struggled with it. I swear it took me almost 6-7 hours to get a perfect A and B side of the Pink Floyd. I took the tape, put it back in the envelope. I put 2 refs in the envelopes, and I walked it back around 5:36 o'clock to the record plant. They put it on in a studio. I think Jock Douglas was a producer at that time, or the engineer mixing guy was there. There were like tons of people in the control room, and they start playing it. 10 minutes into it, you know, they checked the beginning, they checked the middle, especially at the end, because obviously the loudest program is still the end, and that's most impossible to cut on the vinyl. And they said, "Fuck, this is fucking unbelievable, you know. That blows the fucking, you know, record out from our own house over here." So I'm just looking, okay, so what's next? So tell you what, you go back to the studio and you cut the same shit one more time, but exactly the same way. This is the problem with the vinyl. You know, you can cut one vinyl 100% correctly, and the next one won't come out the same because there's so many variables in cutting that you don't know what can go wrong.
Yeah.
It has to be exactly the same way. So I cut the parts next day because obviously it's a big job. You know, I wouldn't stay there from 6 o'clock to 9 o'clock in the evening and try to cut it again. I didn't want to rush it. I said, I'll do it tomorrow. And you'll get a test pressing from Pittman. We had a factory in Pittman, New Jersey, Tyrone, Indiana, and Santa Maria, California. And when we cut the masters for CBS Records, we cut two parts for each plant. I didn't cut the parts till they approved it. So I cut another set of wrap next morning. And at the same time, I cut parts for manufacturing. And I forgot which plant it went to. I don't know if this was Pittman or Terre Haute. They sent the masters to Pittman, Terre Haute. They got the test pressings. Immediately, they were requested back to the producer engineer. They listened to it. And I wouldn't even get a call directly. You know, there was no luxury of having a phone or cell phone or anything. They called the booking department at CBS Records and they told them, whoever this is unbelievable. This is the record. This is what we want to go with. It's approved. It's 100%. Next thing I know, the record goes out. It's freaking, 5 million copies or something?
Yeah.
So next thing I know, CBS like, wow, you know what? Get as much outside work as you want. We don't care. CBS, non-CBS, and then the door just opened, absolutely open. You know, I was working with inside clients, with outside clients, and I was like a golden boy over there. You know, I was just cutting vinyl for the next 38 years. I mean, I cut more vinyl, I can tell you right now, than anybody in this country, I can say safely. I started in 1970, 71. Most of the mastering houses with cutting engineers came in 1976.
Yeah, right.
Including Ludwig and Sterling, you know, they opened in 75 and 76. So I was cutting parts for CBS Records, and I was cutting for clients, whoever wanted it, you know, international clients. I was cutting lacquers for Holland, for Europe. And my biggest jobs were English imports at CBS Records. So I started with Alison Moyet, Paul Young. All the English imports in 70s, you know, late 70s, early 80s came to me. Next thing I know, all the classical records, masterworks. I was like a golden boy. You know, they figure out I would be the guy who would be so careful cutting their records because they're totally anal about the sound. You know, they don't want any limiters. They don't want any high frequency limiters. They don't want any EQ. They just want to have a perfect flat master. So pretty much every new release I cut for masters, every Broadway show. I mean, I was blessed with catalog on CBS Records, from country to classical to jazz to pop. I was the guy to do a first set of lacquers, which is 1A and 1B.
Because
you know, the lacquer comes back for recuts after 25,000 pressings and in another part. But since we had three shifts of six or seven masters working around the clock, and they're mostly recuts, really. Like, if Pittman needed new parts for the album, they would call in, they would recut it. That could be anybody. It wouldn't be me. I did the A and B, but the new one would be cut by somebody else. And that was a problem. Many times people will get these records and they go, what the fuck is this? I mean, it doesn't sound anything like the original record.
Well,
I never saw that record, you know.
Yeah.
I don't know who cut it, you know. I have no idea. That could be a guy at night over there drinking while cutting, you know, and left half of the... you would put your notes on a little cue card. And he would have to prepare the master tape machine alignment, you know, cleaning head. If there was an EQ, he would have to put the EQ on it. He would have to change the EQ on the second track. He would have to change the EQ and a level on the third track. I had no control over that. Whoever did it. And as long as Pittman got the part and the part didn't skip, that's it.
Yeah.
Good. Nobody's comparing it to the original master.
Right. I'd like to jump ahead a little bit because I don't want to keep you longer than I have to here, but there's a lot to get in. So let's just jump ahead a little bit. So you were the golden boy for cutting vinyl, but then when digital happened, what did that do for your career?
You know what? I was scared because obviously it's a new, totally new technology. computers, keyboards. Obviously, there was no plugins or anything like that, but the first digital workstation we worked with was Sonic Solutions.
Yeah.
And first digital console, which came out for mastering, was DTC Neve. Yeah. It was unbelievable console. I fell in love with this console in 3 days, you know. It was one package, everything digital. It had programmable faders, it had programmable EQs. Everything went into a floppy disk, obviously. It wasn't sophisticated programming, but you could memorize the session, and if the client came back next day, you would insert the floppy, and guess what? All the levels, all the fades, all the EQs would pop up. It was unbelievable. And again, working for the big labels, I had the luxury of getting the best equipment I wanted, the best workstation I wanted, whatever I wanted, they would buy. I mean, how many master engineers can say that, you know? When I raised my finger in the studio, I wanted a new EQ. Next day, the new EQ was in the console.
This was still, you were still at CBS then at this time, right?
Yeah, this is CBS. CBS changed to Sony in 1986, just around when CD came out.
Yeah.
And so they bought me the Neve. DTC Neve mastering console was $120,000.
Yeah.
They went out and they bought it. And they asked me, like, what do you think about it? I said to them, I think it's amazing. I mean, this is amazing. The whole package, you know, everything is digital. It was a simple 4-band EQ on it. Like, guess what? It just did the job with all the pull techs I did and everything, and the limiters and noises and patches. And they said, this is unbelievable. I can create the same record, and it's beautiful. So then guess what? They went and they bought two more. Mm. They bought one for L.A. and I think one for Japan, so Sony Japan. It was already Sony at that time, CBS Sony. So, and guess what? I had that console almost till 2003 or 2004. At that time, everything was still 16-bit and 44 kilohertz, you know, so it didn't matter.
Right.
But in late 90, early 2000, already many of these recordings became higher res, 48 kilohertz, 24-bit.
Yeah.
If you remember, Tascam came out with the DAT player, which was recording at 48.
Yeah.
Most of the Sony crap was all 4416, you know, all the decks they had and everything. So classical people, they didn't like that new console. They immediately thought that it's a bad idea to run the program to that. You know, I should use something better. So I said to Sony, if you want something better, then go and buy it, you know. Well, guess what? Next day, they get Harmonia Monday. Remember this?
Yeah.
This was the first digital, a little bit more sophisticated Neve. You could go 24-bit. You can go high res. And they were like modules. You would buy a little case, and you could put the fader over there. You could put the EQ limiter, whatever, high-frequency limiter. And you would build up your console. Well, they bought. They bought lots of them, you know. And all the mastering rooms were refurbished. We still had lots of analog stuff because we were still cutting vinyl. But digital was still in its infancy, you know. But if you had clients who would bring the 48 kilohertz DAT or PCM 9000 or something, you could actually claim, listen, I'll master it at the high res, you know, everything is beautiful. And that's how it worked. And next thing you know, Weiss comes in. A few years later, I would say 2004 or 2005, and they were even better. Suddenly you have a graphic equalizer in front of you, which is pure digital, you know, capable of going to 96 kilohertz, 24-bit. And if you have a graphic displays in front of you, you know, it's just a beautiful thing. And again, so they bought me that. And it was just a natural progression going from analog to digital. And when I was at Sony, it was still cutting vinyl, even though the CD was climbing rapidly and the vinyl was declining rapidly. From everyday cutting, maybe I would cut twice a week, and four times a week I would strictly do digital mastering.
Mm, right.
And sure enough, you know, very well, by the 2004-05, vinyl was almost disappearing completely.
Let's jump ahead until now. What are you using now? I know you now opened up your own facility in Charleston. Tell me about that. Mm-hmm. Why you moved to Charleston, first of all, and the gear that you have, and how you transitioned to what you have now.
Well, What happened, you know, well, Sony shut down in 2007. They pretty much realized building studios already around mid-2000s was a very expensive proposition. And Sony was very generous. They built a beautiful studio on 54th Street between 9th and 10th Avenue, corner of 10th Avenue. And it's supposed to be a showcase for Sony products, you know. They had a recording stages, they had mastering rooms, they had mixing rooms. It was really one of the most beautiful places I ever worked in. It was very different than CBS Records. It was, they put so much money in that facility, it was almost unbelievable. And they built me a gorgeous mastering room. I mean, I had a palace. If there are any pictures on the internet from the room where I was at Sony, you wouldn't believe that it was a mastering room. It looked like a movie theater.
Yeah.
And it was pretty much all digital already, but we had loads of tape machines. You know, if you wanted ATR, you had two track over there. If you wanted Studer, you would have a Studer. Whatever you wanted, they had analog, digital. So they pretty much built, it was more digital than analog, but if the client wanted analog, because there's still believers in 2000, 2003, that the analog is still better. Even though you're ending up with a CD at the end of the day, you still have to convert everything, but you want to start with analog. So we had everything. It was up to the client to tell me what they want, and I would work. You know, I had SPL EQs, analog EQs, I had Massenburg EQs, I had Focusrite EQs, I had a Weiss EQ, I had a Theseus EQ. It's almost like you pick what you want, and that's what you get. Very few studios could offer this kind of, you know, luxury. Obviously, again, you're working for Sony. So 2007 comes up, 2006, and suddenly there are rumors they're going to shut down. You know, label is not shutting down, but it just, they can't make any money on the studio, you know. Hit Factory shut down a year and a half before across the street on 54th Street. So we knew the writing on the wall.
Yeah.
And they were one of the most beautiful studios, too. Sure enough, 2007, early, I was at the Grammys, like around February of 2007. And I hear the rumor in the hotel, they're like, people from Sony, did you hear? They're going to shut down the studio. I said, you might be fucking kidding, you know? I mean, they're going to shut down? I mean, they're doing so good, you know, they're live concerts from the stage on 54th Street, you know, live by request, you know, they have mixing room, they have video posts, audio posts. You could walk into this building in the morning and walk out in the evening with a complete video, record, DVD, whatever you want, DVD authoring. Well, the rumors start to get even bigger. March, April. Sure enough, Sony calls a meeting around, I think it was like April or May of 2007. You're going to shut down. They're going to shut down everything, sell everything, and that's it. So, 2007, they shut down. So immediately, I wound up at Universal Mastering, which is on Broadway on 56th Street.
Yeah.
And guess what? Paul is my boss. Paul is head of Universal Mastering Studio.
Yeah, sure.
So he immediately picked me up, and we had a great year. I mean, we were doing records over there, everything from Linkin Park to Shakira to... Weezer. I mean, we were cranking records at that time. Bocelli. I mean, huge albums. I mean, I brought more money to that mastering room in a few months than that room made in 3 years, you know.
Yeah.
Next thing I know, 2.5 years later, there's a rumor Universal is going to shut down the mastering in New York. And I said to myself, this is crazy, you know, this is really crazy. Here we're making money, but obviously the labels are not interested in studios and mastering rooms because they can contract the whole thing outside.
Yeah.
And it's probably cheaper for them than keeping me on the payroll, benefits and everything. And I'm not the only one. There are lots of other people. So sure enough, they shut down. So I was like panicking. I have all this gear. I mean, I have a beautiful gear. I have PMCs, I have Weisses, I have ZCs, I have a console, I have the whole thing. What do I do? Put it in storage, you know? I mean, it's a total waste of money. What do I do? So I approached MasterDisc. And at that time, MasterDisc was owned by Scott Hall, if you remember.
Yes, I do. Yeah.
It wasn't an original MasterDisc. The name was the same, but it wasn't the same, you know, owner.
Mm-hmm.
And obviously, he made a deal with me. He says, I'll give you a room. You can bring all your gear over there, and you know, I'll make a deal, and you work with me. I went there, and I was really happy. It's a room wasn't exactly the, you know, best room, you know, I ever had, because coming out of Sony, or Universal, I was spoiled. You know, they're like really build rooms, isolation and acoustics. You know, they spend hundreds of thousands of dollars. The Masters look like any room you would see in Manhattan, you know. So next thing, I worked over there two and a half years. He's pretty much going out of business. So I said to myself, this is it. Never again I'm going to work for anybody. There's no reason. I have my own clients. I have my own gear. What am I doing over here, really? Every time I move somewhere, another shutdown, you know.
Yeah.
So then again, I had a great 2 years over there working major albums, tons of money. So I said to myself, you know what? What's the next step? And Paul, if you remember, Paul was let go also because Universal were downsizing.
Yes, right.
And once they shut down the East Coast studios, they certainly didn't need him because they have tons of people in L.A. They still have like a production studio in L.A. And they could make somebody else vice president or director and pay them. So they let him go. And I really like Paul. I mean, Paul gave me a chance. He hired me. So I called Paul. I mean, like, what's going on? I mean, this is a third try for me with, you know, after Sony, Universal Masters, now they shut down. So why don't you go to Charleston, you know? There's a Charleston, where the fuck is Charleston, you know? I mean, I knew about Charleston because my daughter went to school in South Carolina, to University of South Carolina, which is in Columbia, South Carolina.
Yeah, yeah.
And on the weekend, we would make a trip to Charleston. And it's a beautiful town. It's a gorgeous little town. And it's a very touristy town. I mean, when I came over here, I knew this is 100% tourist trap over here. It's just a beautiful place. And he tells me, I have a house in Charleston. There's a studio, and you should go check it out. You could set up your studio over there, and you'd be so happy. You know, you can get out of New York and taxes and all this stuff. So sure enough, I came down to Charleston, and I went to check out the studio. First, I didn't know there is a studio in Charleston. I'm like, who would build a studio in Charleston?
Yeah, right, right.
Sure enough. There's a recording studio, there's a tracking room, there's a production room, there's a master. There wasn't a master room, there used to be like a little mixing room, but it's acoustically treated. It was designed by an acoustic designer. He's from North Carolina. Beautiful, beautiful little package, you know. It's almost like a little mini Sony, you know. It's not huge, it's small. It's a one-room operation, one mixing room, one tracking room, production room, and where I have now mastering them. So I talked to the owner and I said to him, like, would you consider, you know, like if I would set up a shop over here? But the first, what I have to do, I have to measure my gear because my speakers are huge. They're massive. They're like freaking 11 feet tall and then 3 feet wide, you know, and I have five of them. You know, we have to put them somewhere in the room. So he emptied the room where he used to have like a little mixing console over here just for post-production. And I says, I'll give you this room. See if it fits. If it fits, it's yours. You'll make a deal. You'll pay me the rent, whatever. It's yours. Measured. Sure enough, it fit.
Wow.
And that's a history. Brought everything down. So I'm using Weiss's. I'm using Zeiss's. I have the atomic clock, isochrome, antelope. So it's the beautiful mastering room. And again, it's all Sony gear, Sony wiring, whatever they built for me at the shrunk it to a smaller console, obviously. We bought Sterling modular and everything fits into that. But my metering system, everything's from Sony. I have a PC Electronics. I have a Pro Tools. I have a Sequoia. Now it's lots of plugins over here, but I still don't like to use plugins. I still believe in the hardware, you know, and Weiss is one of the best VQs you can get these days. Like,
so you're doing digital hardware then and not analog, or do you go out into the analog domain sometimes too?
No, it's, I would say, 99% digital.
Okay.
Every file which comes from label, independent clients, they're all files sent over the internet or delivered over here. And they're high res. They start at 96. Some of them are only 48. Once in a while, we get a 44 kilohertz file, 16-bit, and then we tell client, why don't you just record at the high res? You know, you're wasting your headroom and everything else recording at low res.
Yeah, yeah.
So, but analog is pretty much dead, you know. A few clients I had who would deliver half-inch tape or one-inch tape, one-inch two-track, even they are gone already.
Yeah.
The only guy who is still doing analog, and I respect him, is Jack White.
Yeah, yeah.
He still believes in one-inch two-track. And God bless him, you know, he can do it. But, you know, it's okay if you wind up in vinyl, you know, if your final destination is vinyl. But if you're doing a CD, DVD, what's the point?
Yeah, sure.
You have to convert it somewhere, you know. So why go through all the pain? And then it will go to a converter, and that's it. It's digital again. So why not start again digital and just do your best? You know, you can create an analog sound from digital, but you cannot create a digital sound on analog.
Yeah,
it just
yeah.
won't happen.
I have a couple more questions for you, and then I know you're busy, so I'll let you go. The first one is, tell me about your workshop. I saw that you have a mastering workshop. Tell me about that.
Well, here we go. You know, my opportunity to get into the business was in golden years of recording, you know. The records were selling in millions. Labels were cranking out the records, LPs, like there was no tomorrow. I mean, you would have 5-7 releases in a week, just from one label. Then you combine RCA, Warner Brothers, CBS. There were maybe 20 releases in a month for the new albums, and every one of them would hit 800,000, 1 million. The record was good. It went to 3, 5, 7, 10 million records. Well, I was trained by the best people, most professional people, people who knew their business, cutting. I didn't have to go to school. You know, my school was right there at the work. And I figured out for the new generation today, where do they learn mastering? And what really got me, when I worked at Sony, when I worked at Universal, even the masters, we used to have interns coming to the studio. And some of them are from Berklee School of Music. Some of them were from NYU in New York. Some of them were from Full Sail in Florida. And they would always ask me, what do I do? And I was like, what do you mean, what do? I do mastering. And I was like, mastering? Like, what do you do? So mastering is like total secret taboo in all these schools. They mention it, but they never go deep enough to it. You know, like, yeah, once it's mixed and finished, it goes to mastering, they finalize, and that's it. Well, there's a little bit more to it than finalizing it. So I figured, why don't I start a workshop, you know? I mean, I would love to teach the younger generation to have the opportunity to learn. I cannot guarantee them the jobs, but I can teach them the best way I can. And I certainly have enough experience, you know.
Yeah.
Nobody can take it away from me. Over 40 years of recording from Celine Dion to Red Hot Chili Peppers, you show me a few mastering guys who did that.
How long is your mastering workshop then? Is it like a weekend? Is it a week?
It's 3 days, 3 full days, mm-hmm. minimum 8 hours. It's 24 hours. And it's a hands-on. They come to my room. It's a small class. I don't take more than 3 people over here, because obviously I want to spend as much as I can with the individual person. And they can actually see, they can hear, they can touch, they can work on the same program I work daily over here. And these are not some albums I take out of the box, you know, which I mastered 40 years ago and I tried to remaster them. No, this is the current stuff I'm working on.
Mm-hmm.
If I'm working on a top project today and they happen to be with me, guess what? They master it with me. They hear it. And we put different genres of music. That's another beauty. I can say I can work with classical music. I can work with hip-hop. I can work with heavy metal. I can work with Chinese music. I work with Israeli music. You tell me what you want to work, and I'll work with you. And I open my drives. There's a whole catalog of music you wouldn't believe. And these are all current albums I work on.
Yeah, yeah.
So how bad is that? You know, that's better than Full Sail, better than NYU or Berklee, you know. I mean, it amazes me that when I get these questions from students and asking me about mastering, like, here you're spending $250,000 on your education, and you ask me what mastering is?
Yeah,
that's
right.
That's pretty sad.
Yeah. Well, that's cool that you're doing that. That's a great idea. I'm sure that your
and
students
nobody
get a lot
does
out of it.
And I really don't know why nobody does it. You know, I have no fear of losing clients or losing job. You know, I have clients. If you look at my discography, most of it's all repeat clients. You know, if they like you in mastering business, you know very well, if they like you, they'll come back. If they don't like you, you'll never see them again.
Yeah, right.
So by teaching, and another thing I can tell you, I had classes. It started mostly international from Europe. We had people from France, from Germany, from Poland, from Israel, from Sweden, from South America. Most of them went to open their own little mastering rooms. I mean, how bad is that? You know, here they got so excited, they got the start. The next thing I go and I get an invitation to come to Germany. Guy opened his own master room. He's so happy. Guy in Italy opened his own master room. Guy in Poland opened his own master room. So obviously I'm giving him something which is very valuable.
Yeah, congratulations. That's great. Last question. What's the best piece of business advice that you either received from someone along the way or that you learned yourself along the way?
Best business, like your job. You're mastering, you have to love what you're doing, you know. And you're dealing with different personalities. You're dealing with lots of egos. Don't try to educate the client how they should record or how you can tell them what the master should be when they deliver, but don't try to correct them on everything what they do, because they already created the master, they elect a master. They just ask you to make it a little bit better. So be truthful, be nice, and at the end of the day, it's really about work you give it to them. You know, it's not the reviewers out there, you know, who will step on you all over the place and criticize your work. I work with clients and I report to clients. And my satisfaction, my happiness is if I get a call from a client back and he tells me, Vlado, the sound is amazing. It's amazing. And this is after they already had a master, which is amazing, which they like. So this is your, satisfaction. And I just love work. I mean, look, I'm probably the only guy in the country, if not in the world, who is over 40 years and still master. I mean, how many people are doing it?
Well, you sound so enthusiastic still, and that says a lot because a lot of people are burned out. You know, you get along doing it a long time, and it's been one of those things where you think you've seen it all and done it all, but you're very enthusiastic about what you're doing still.
I am. But you know what? It comes from my beginning, humble beginnings. You know, I know I came here. I could have been working for maybe a telephone company, running optical cables or something in the 70s or whatever. No, I wound up in a record business. I embraced it immediately. And in early days in mastering wasn't very glamorous. You were cutting lacquers. We were just like a factory. You know?
Yeah.
So everybody, if I would mention somebody mastering, you're not mixing? No, I'm mastering. So there you go. We were like, you know, second tier of the whole business, or third. Now, mastering is very important. You know, there's another record out there which is not mastered. You know, there are only a few people in the world who do it. So I'm very happy I stuck with mastering. I can tell you that. Very happy.
Vlado, thanks so much for your time today. This was terrific. There's so much more I'd like to ask you, and maybe we can revisit this at some point in time. Thanks so much, Vlado.
Thank you. It was nice talking to you. Thank you very much.
Likewise. Thanks. Likewise. Bye. To find out more about Vlado, go to vladomastering.com. That's VLADO mastering, all one word, vladomastering.com. Thanks for listening and being in my inner circle. Remember, if you have any questions or comments, you can send them to questions@bobbyoinnercircle.com. Many, many thanks to Steve Cherubino. He's the host of the EDM Producer Podcast at edmmr.com, and he helps put the show together. Many, many thanks, Steve. To listen to other episodes of Bobby Osinski's Inner Circle, go to bobbyosinski.com and select the podcast tab, or go to bobbyoinnercircle.com or find it in iTunes, Stitcher, Mixcloud, or Google Play. At bobbyosinski.com and bobbyoinnercircle.com, you'll find a sign-up form for my newsletter and for alerts for new podcasts. This is Bobby Osinski. I'll see you next time.